proceed. You need a few more minutes to get squared away, or are you all set?
I think I'm all set.
Okay.
With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Roger Randolph. We presented the court with 10 separate issues, all of which we believe show that reversal of his convictions is warranted. I was going to start off with the cross-examination issue, because in every murder case, a coroner is one of the most important witnesses that takes a stand. In this case, the state noticed Dr. Tonegraf, but they didn't present him. Instead, they presented Dr. Garvin. I was not able to locate a notice for Dr. Garvin in the record. But what happened was, we did object. And the state said, well, Dr. Tonegraf can't be here this day on Friday, or they can't be here on Monday. They didn't say whether he could be there the next day. But the court let Dr. Garvin testify. And I submit to you, this is a violation of Mr. Randolph's right of confrontation under the Sixth Amendment, because the autopsy report and the autopsy are testimonial evidence. There's certainly no evidence that he was not available to testify on a different day, and they did not ask for continuance. Roger was prejudiced by this because we needed to have the original coroner there, because one of the issues was the trajectory of the bullet. The bullet that was recovered was fragmented. And there was testimony by two witnesses that only three shots were fired. One witness said the bullets were hitting the ground. So there's a question whether or not Roger had directly pointed a gun towards the victim in this case, Rashid, who was also known as Boxer Roe, or if he had done more of a warning type shot to the ground and it had ricocheted up. So that was important. We did not have him here to testify. Another issue that is a problem is the Atkins hearing. I'm going to ask the court to look at the procedures in an Atkins hearing. Now, I know that Roger did not get the death penalty, but he's still with our death penalty jury. And when we had the Atkins hearing, the defense presented Dr. Kearns, who testified as to his evaluations that he had done on Roger, and he had talked to his mother, and he had obtained some other evaluations when Roger was in school. The state presented a detective. And I suggest to you that under the Finger case, the state needs to present an expert. In fact, that's what the statute suggests. The statute suggests that when the court is going to hold an Atkins hearing to decide whether or not it's striking the death penalty, the court has to require the defendant provide documentation and allow the defendant to be interviewed by the prosecutor. In this case, they decided not to. In fact, at one point, the court said, well, aren't you going to have a doctor come in and testify? And they said, no, not at this time, not unless we need to. So the state was going to wait to see if the court ruled that Roger had shown by preponderance of the evidence that he was mentally retarded before they were even going to proceed with any expert testimony. The problem we had at the hearing is that the doctor was conclusive on two points under the Atkins, but he kind of waffled a little bit on the third, and that was the onset of the mental deficiency. And part of the problem was the records in Louisiana were rather vague and not complete because he did not have the raw data. But I submit to you that judge made an incorrect decision by suggesting that we had not proven by preponderance of the evidence that Roger was mentally retarded because the state didn't present an expert to rebut anything we did. Now, going to trial on a death penalty case, after the court made this erroneous decision, we asked for jury questionnaires, which are normally submitted to about 200 people. The court said no. That was erroneous because the standards on the Judicial College are that there should be jury questionnaires sent out to the jurors ahead of time. In this case, we only had 42 jurors, and there were no African Americans. The second day of jury selection, our attorney objected for the lack of African Americans. And the court immediately wanted her to concede that, well, there's no proof that there's a problem with the selection process. She did not concede. She just said, I would say I don't have any documentation at the present that would show that there was some sort of selection problem, but there are no African Americans in this veneer. What the court did then is just continued the jury selection process. Nothing else happened. So basically,
well, counsel, I don't read the record to say that counsel sought anything else. Counsel didn't ask for a hearing about the selection process in Clark County. Counsel didn't make a request for the veneer distribution process. Is that true or not?
That's true. And in the recent Williams case, that actually did happen, where they did ask to go ahead and question the jury commissioner. But the court had already made the decision before the questioning had occurred. But I bring this to the court's attention because it's a common practice here. Before you even ask for anything, the judge says, well, we don't have any statistics. We don't have anything. And even if she had,
I don't know about the common practice, but I would think that the recent cases from this court have made it clear that when counsel makes requests for information, good example is the Avzali decision, the court has an obligation to allow the defense to develop its cross-section concerns.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And what's missing in this case is anything beyond the objection, I don't see any African Americans in the veneer, but nothing else.
That is correct, Your Honor. She did not pursue it any further than that. And this was about 2 years before Avzali and Williams came down. So, I mean, we do have precedent now to require some more information. So, yes, the court is correct. She did not pursue it any further. I wanted to also address the problems that occurred with Roger wanting to represent himself. At least six times he filed motions. And then the first time in his arraignment, he says, I want to fire her. What happened repeatedly for about 2 years was that the court just said, okay, you've got a good attorney, and, you know, I'll have her talk to you. And finally, when they're getting closer to trial, the state and the defense attorney say, we need to have a Young hearing. I'll submit to you, waiting 2 years is a little too long to wait for a Young hearing when this has been going on for so long. And even though at the hearing, Roger did say he wanted his attorney, we know that after the trial, he began filing motions again, which takes us into the rule EDC 3.70. He filed a motion for judgment of acquittal and motion for a new trial, which was never heard because under the 8 judicial district rules in the criminal area, a criminal defendant is not allowed to file documents if he is represented by an attorney, which Roger was. And we argue that that violates his rights to due process and access to the courts because the rules are not the same for civil litigants in the 8th Judicial District Court, and they're not the same throughout the state. In fact, the second district seems to be more lenient on filings for criminal defendants than they are in other areas. Because he was not allowed to have his motions filed, there was no decision. So he lost his right to appeal, possibly an erroneous decision, which would have been other issues that we would have been able to present to this court. Now, I know the state says, well, that judge has retired. However, it still would have heard, somebody would have heard the case or heard the motions, rather, and made a decision regarding that. Court's indulgence. Did the court have any other questions about any specific areas that we addressed? Because I know that there are 10 different areas, and I've only touched on a few.
You may wish to save this for rebuttal, but I wondered about the argument that the Confrontation Clause violations were harmless. Would you prefer to address that on rebuttal, or would you like to take that up now?
I could address that on rebuttal if the court wants. I had one other issue I wanted to touch on briefly, and that was the closing rebuttal argument where the prosecutor argued there is no not guilty by mental retardation and suggested that the expert, Dr. Kern, was not totally honest with the jury. Basically, he said, my comments and argument is that Dr. Kern tailored his testimony to fit the defense's perspective. I think that's a disparaging comment on the defense theory of the case, and it was inaccurate that the jury could not consider mental retardation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Dickinson. Mr. Stanton.
Thank you and good afternoon. David Stanton on behalf of the state. Roshi Wells was a former Olympic boxer. In 1996, he represented the United States in Atlanta, Georgia, won a bronze medal as a boxer at those athletic games. And the reason why that's relevant in part is what I read in both the opening brief at page 29 and 30 and on page 1 prominently in the reply. And what I don't think one is entitled to do on appeal is to rewrite the trial record. Roshi Wells was well known in this community. He had a son who lived there with his mother and was visiting his minor child, who was 2 on the day he was murdered. It was an area about the size of this chamber, as reflected in the photographs of this case. And as I'm standing here at the podium, was kind of representative of where Mr. Wells was standing when he was murdered. There wasn't anything surrounding him other than his 2-year-old son standing next to him and a dirt lot. And thus, the relevance of that is the claim that this bullet ricocheted off of dirt and came up and struck the fatal wound into his femoral artery at his hip, approximately 3 feet on an adult male, is preposterous. Not only would it defy the laws of physics, it would defy forensic science, and most importantly, it would defy what the trial evidence was. The evidence was that the defendant shot the victim with a very high-powered rifle. That, going through Mr. Wells' body, caused the deformation of the bullet, and that there was no testimony, zero, that indicated that this was a ricochet or could have been a byproduct of a ricochet. There wasn't anything around him. He was standing out in the open. Even if there was a cement area in front of him, the forensic testimony would have been, had it been ever raised, that a ricochet of a bullet with a lead core doesn't occur like counsel now wants to suggest, that it was a ricochet. And thus, leading up to the argument about the testimony, it's not Garvin, it's Gavin, and it's Dr. Telgenhoff. Dr. Telgenhoff was the physician who performed the autopsy on Mr. Wells. He was unavailable for trial, the entirety of the trial, and he, Dr. Telgenhoff, or his designee, was endorsed as the expert witness in the case. There was no prohibition for defense counsel from exploring fully, fairly, and with complete vigor, any theory that the bullet had been the product of a ricochet. The bullet was impounded as evidence. It was available for anybody to inspect, had they decided to do so, or review through an expert witness, of which trial counsel elected not to do. They never looked at it. They never have it evaluated by another expert, because these 2 very knowledgeable trial lawyers knew that that was a theory that they could not present because it held no weight and had no evidence to support it. Additionally, counsel indicated for the first time that I've read that now a Atkins hearings requires the state to present expert testimony to rebut a claim and a burden that squarely rests on a defendant to establish mental impairment for purposes of the Atkins decision. I, as trial counsel for the state, made the determination clearly in reviewing the evidence presented to me as required by that statute prior to the hearing that in simple terms that they had not satisfied by the doctor's own reports and testing of the defendant the prongs necessary to satisfy Atkins. It was clear to the court, it was clear to the state, that no expert was needed to rebut it because their doctor, and to borrow appellant's counsel's words before this court this afternoon, that he, quote, kind of waffled, close quote, on the third prong. He did no such thing. He didn't waffle. He said that they review the evidence as an expert. To his credit, he fairly stated, I can't say that he meets that criteria. He testified to that at the Atkins hearing, and he testified consistently at trial. And thus, that leads to the question and comment of the prosecutor, myself, that it was undoubtedly a fair comment, not even approaching prosecutorial misconduct, to comment on the doctor's finding, to comment on that conduct is irrelevant for purposes of the jury's consideration, because there is no verdict that addressed the relevancy of that mental state. It certainly was relevant, as argued by a very experienced trial counsel, an attempt to support what their theory of trial was. Don't convict the defendant of first-degree murder, convict him of second-degree murder. That was unsuccessful. And it was unsuccessful because the evidence in this case, frankly, Your Honors, was overwhelming. There were three eye or ear witnesses to the actual shooting, that the wound was significant because it was fired from a high-powered rifle, and unfortunately, the nature and location with that velocity of bullet caused a fatal injury to the victim.
Well, the jury actually heard the testimony from the doctor, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I seem to think that maybe this issue of Atkins is moot because it didn't happen. In other words, this was not a death penalty case. The death penalty was not used, and the jury still heard it, so even if it's some type of error, is it harmless beyond the Constitution, beyond a reasonable doubt?
I would think so, for those reasons. I mean, the issue of the court's assessment of the Atkins evidence was, I think, based upon the record and the defense's own doctor in failing to meet the three-prong test.
They didn't use the Fox defense, did they? Mental retardation and that Fox produces where the person is capable of premeditating but didn't premeditate in this case? Is that the defense they used?
Well, Judge, you know Fox apparently a lot better than I do, but in this case...
I used it, it never worked, so...
In this case, what I think the defense clearly was the mental health to address some sort of sympathy for the defense, but it was pretty clear from the facts to argue that he couldn't premeditate, where he specifically challenges Mr. Wells that he's going to come back and in very vulgar, direct terms says, you better not be here when I come back, drives directly to his home where the weapon was, retrieves the weapon, comes back, loads it, and then fires multiple rounds, all evidencing an intent to kill, the mental state to formulate what he's doing, and obviously striking a man probably at a distance of a little bit more than where I'm standing to the wall, to your justice's far right. So it's certainly within three shots moving. That was a compelling piece of evidence that the defense had to overcome. Not only mentioning that after he did this act, he was in a very cognitive, deliberate fashion, returned home, secreted the murder weapon now at his, not at his home, but in a very unique area in his next door neighbor's, which was an abandoned or a foreclosed home no one living in, and then proceeded to pack his vehicle and was in flight to the general Arizona Phoenix area when he was taken into custody. So they had problems about the mental state of premeditation, cognition, and deliberation prior to, during, and after this murder. As far as the questionnaire, I don't believe the court erred in denying the questionnaire. There was no compelling reason given to the court that, based upon either the pretrial publicity or any other fact of this case, that would cause or mandate a questionnaire to be given. A final comment to the court would be the selection process of the jurors in this case. The court inquired of counsel about trial counsel's request and objection to develop the record further. And might I just add that in my experience, not only the requirement if you're going to say, hey, there's the panel, the denier that's called in here is somehow unrepresentative of some ethnic group or groups, that the manner in which to develop that record is relatively easy. And one of the most compelling things that I've observed is a district court that said, because I believe the visual examination and then looking at the names is an imprecise manner to determine the ethnicity component of the voir dire. And that what a district court did that I thought was compelling and very easily done is inquired of all the prospective when the objection is made and to develop the record, is to then ask all members of the voir dire whether or not they claim an ethnic background, and then to denote that in the numbers and the exact ones that they suggest that they fell under, precisely for the record. Very easy to do, not all that time-consuming, and much more precise than some sort of visual examination or looking at surnames and then drawing some inference from that. Not only was that not done in this case, it wasn't done because it was never requested. The jury commissioner was never asked to come up, and no evidentiary hearing was produced or requested by trial counsel at the selection process of the jury. So I would submit that neither of these issues raised by the court have any legal or factual merit. With that, any questions from the court? Thank you very much for your time.
All right, Ms. Dickinson.
I wanted to first address some of the facts. This incident happened in a courtyard area, a small courtyard area. In fact, it is an exhibit that's part of the appendix. And the testimony was everybody was sitting when he came up. He had a towel over something, and they saw a rifle. There's no evidence that he was loading the rifle at that scene, none at all. There's no evidence that the bullets were shot directly towards any of the people. In fact, if you looked at the state's brief, on pages 14 through 16, you can read the testimony that indicates the bullets hit the ground. So that was the basis of, in closing, our argument that there was no intent to kill, that the bullets were not the gun was not pointed directly, the bullets had ricocheted and hit the ground. With regard to the error in the cross-examination of the different doctor, I want to point out that the crux of the confrontation issue, we need to confront and cross-examine an attending forensic pathologist, is important because it's the only vehicle by which a criminal defendant may explore the subjectivity involved in the performance of the forensic autopsy. So it needs to be preserved. It's just like anything else. If I had an alibi witness and I lost the witness before trial started, I don't have them. I don't have any testimony. When they have a forensic doctors, the coroner here, they need to preserve and make sure that he is there at the trial to testify so that we can cross-examine him. Because this is subjective. This is not the Bull Cumming, like the Bull Cumming case and the other Supreme Court cases, where the issue is it's a lab test that somebody runs through a machine. This is very subjective.
Ms. Dickinson, did the defense move for continuance? They moved for continuance.
They objected to...
They moved for continuance.
No, they did not.
Okay, and you do have investigators at the public defender's office, is that correct?
We do.
Was an investigator sent out to subpoena this doctor that didn't that was unavailable?
I do not know when they first found out he was not showing up. I do know that they did not provide notice with the second doctor. I couldn't find that in
the other cases, you don't take an investigator into the courtroom with you?
I don't know if they had an investigator there. I don't know. But it's the state's burden to preserve the evidence and preserve the coroner and have him there. They could have asked for
But sometimes if things don't go your way in trial, you have to use your imagination, such as, Judge, we'd like a continuance. Judge, Phil Cohn, send over an investigator. Let's issue a subpoena and then call the witness later on in your case, the pathologist, the medical examiner.
That would be an option if they knew in advance.
It just makes it difficult for us to try to find error in these cases when there's other means that could have been used. You know, maybe it's ineffective assistance of counsel from Ms. Craig and Mr. O'Brien rather than reversal on appeal in this
case.
Well,
I would suggest that the same rules that apply to the defense should apply to the prosecutor. And by that I mean if they lose their witness, they've lost them. They should not be able to all of a sudden at the 11th hour show up with someone else who's read through the report and gets to testify. It would be the same thing if this was a drug case and they lost the drugs. They couldn't come in and have somebody testify and say, well, I remember putting them there, and this is what they look like. I think the same rules should apply to the state when they have an important witness, such as this, the coroner, is going to testify to the manner of death. And so I don't think the burden needs to be on us to go find them. I think they need to bring them there to testify.
The list of witnesses did say this this doctor are designated, right?
That I don't remember. I do remember that, I guess he's saying I'm mispronouncing everybody's names here, right? I do remember that the one doctor was listed and the other one wasn't.
But in fairness to both parties, it looks like they both the state and Mr. Randolph misspelled Dr. Galvin's name.
Oh, we did?
In the briefs, yeah. It's okay. Get the point.
Okay. Does the court have any other questions? I could go into some of the other issues. I guess I won't.
I don't think so, Ms. Dickinson, and thank you for your arguments here today and your briefing, and Mr. Stanton as well. The court will be in recess, and this case is submitted.